Esto es Hablemos Escritoras, un proyecto dedicado a difundir la obra de escritoras contemporáneas y de todos los tiempos. Yo soy Adriana Pacheco, parte de este equipo que lleva cada semana dos episodios a todos ustedes y cada fin de semana una nota en nuestro blog. Esta es nuestra sección de podcast grabados originalmente en inglés. Es una gran colaboración en donde muchas se unen a nuestro proyecto. Liliana Valenzuela, traductora, es una de ellas y viene a nuestro micrófono para conversar con escritoras que prefieren grabar en inglés. En ese caso, muchas veces yo estoy tras bambalinas, grabando la conversación y dándole la bienvenida a la invitada que tenemos en esa ocasión. Se imaginará la emoción que me da escucharlas en conversación, sobre todo cuando se trata de una escritora como Julia Álvarez, un verdadero pilar de nuestra literatura en los Estados Unidos, pionera en la creación de una literatura de origen hispano en este país. A Julia Álvarez le debemos mucho. Es Viviana Castiblanco, de HarperCollins, quien hizo esto posible, que llegara Julia Álvarez a Hablemos Escritoras. Y es porque queremos celebrar con ella la traducción de un libro que es una total, total belleza, El cementerio de los libros olvidados. A pesar de que Julia Álvarez nos diga que no habla bien español, escucharán qué belleza, cómo disfruta esas lecturas, cómo disfruta escritoras como Gabriela Mistral. Es verdaderamente una conversación entrañable la que van a escuchar ahora con Liliana y con Julia. Sean todos bienvenidos y demos un verdadero tributo a este gran pilar de la literatura. Bienvenidos.
Hello, this is Liliana Valenzuela with Hablemos Escritoras. And today is a very special day. We have as our guest Julia Álvarez, a very prolific, wonderful, deep writer. Hello, Julia. Welcome.
Hola. Thank you, Liliana, for inviting me to this podcast. Hablemos Escritoras. Thank you.
Yes, I'll give a brief introduction because you're so well known in the United States and I think, you know, of course, the Dominican Republic, where you're from, and many other countries because you have traveled widely. You have so many accomplishments, so many books, so many projects, but I want to give readers and people who are new to your work an idea of your career. And you came from the Dominican Republic to the United States as a child, and then your education continued to be in English from then on. And you have taught at different universities in the United States, have written many books, that of which we'll touch on the different books to give people an idea of your whole oeuvre. And then we'll focus on your latest novel, El Cementerio de los Cuentos Sin Contar, The Cemetery of Untold Stories. And you have also had so many awards, including one of your first books, How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accent, in 1991, got an award by the New York Times and Library Journal. You have also received honorary PhDs, have been declared the Woman of the Year by Latina Magazine in 2000, and have received the Medal of the Arts by then-President Barack Obama in 2014. And the list is very long. And of all these accomplishments, what are you most proud of?
Ay, bueno, Liliana. First of all, apologies to your listeners. I wish I were totally confident in Spanish, that I could speak to you in Spanish. Lamentablemente, we came to this country in 1960 when there was no such thing as bilingual education, when the teachers would punish us if they caught us speaking in Spanish, my sisters and myself. I became dominant in English, and that is a loss that I acknowledge. But anyhow, what am I most proud of? First of all, hearing your list, I'm exhausted, which tells me I have been in this craft for now, over 50 years. And yet, you know, each time I sit down to write, I am a beginner. I am a novice because I've never written the book that I'm in the process of writing. So I have to forget all my tricks and anything that any award or anything, because the muse, actually the characters don't listen. They don't care. They have their own stories to tell. But I guess what I am proud of is that we as a community of escritoras, and I also would like to acknowledge our compañeros, escritores, when we started, we were considered not part of American literature, North American literature, that is. We were sociology. Maybe regional publishers published a small print run of our books. But what I feel proud of, and it's still an ongoing lucha and struggle, is that we've created a literature in this country that includes us, and also is aware of the rich literature south of the borders, because that is American literature too. I feel gratified by the progress we've made, and sometimes a little frustrated by what remains to be done, because so much remains to be done.
Yes, you were one of the pioneers of that first wave of Latina writers at that time, who opened this path for many others who have come after you. And you kind of made your way as you went along, which was admirable, and faced a lot of obstacles, as you mentioned. So yeah, kudos to you for persisting and for being a pathfinder and a path maker. And like Machado said, al andar se hace el camino.
Right.
Yeah, like, and especially for your generation, you totally created a new path for many of us. So I thank you personally. And I think I also want to add that on a personal note, I have also been your translator for, I think it's 5 of your books.
Yes.
Which has been a huge privilege, including some of your young adult books, como La Tía Lola Vino de Visita, Quedarse Antes de Ser Libres, Encontrando Milagros, A Gift of Gracias, and the book about the quinceañera. So,
y de volver al...
Volver al remitente.
Sí.
Sí, de volver al remitente. Sí, so I feel very honored and very close to your work, because, you know, when you work with a writer as a translator, you really get in there at the level of the sentence, of the word choice, your themes. And you know, I have really enjoyed working with such a Polish writer who has such great craft, but also the heart, and is able to make us feel all these emotions, you know, and that goes for this latest book too. So I think you spent the whole gamut.
Yeah. Well, thank you too, because as someone that is English dominant, and I've read many Latin American authors in translation, because, you know, I haven't had the time to struggle through the Spanish, or sometimes I read the Spanish alongside the English because I'm not that fluent in the Spanish. I am very indebted to good translators like yourself, like Frances Riddle, who's translated Piñeiro, and others, because without them, I would have a big gap on my imaginative bookshelf. So thank you. We're in this together.
Yes, yeah, no, great pleasure. And looking at your work, you started with How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, which was that recent immigrant girl experience, and also sisterhood, also one of your big topics. How do you look back on that inaugural book that launched your career?
Bueno, and I've been writing for 25 years. But as I mentioned at the beginning, there wasn't a market, or so the big publishers thought, out there for our literature. And I had gotten a lot of rejection and disappointment. And I just kept writing because, you know, it was what was in me to do. And I always have been interested in the gaps in the bookshelf, the things that are missing, the silences. And I didn't have access or knew when I was beginning as a young writer, any books about the immigrant experience from the female point of view. I mean, there was Piri Tomás, and then came Oscar Ihuelos, there was Edward Rivera, and there were wonderful books and address immigration from the Caribbean in those cases from the male point of view, but there was nothing about the female experience and what that was like and the conflicts and the, you know, the patriarchy and the feminism, that encounter, all of it. And so in a way, I was writing how the Garcia girls lost their accents to understand and map out that territory that I had never seen in a book. So that's, you know, that's how I began with Garcia Girls, which, as I said, was published when I was 41 and did well. And then, you know, the next book was a little easier for my publisher to take the risk. And there were more Latina writers coming in. And we suddenly, they realized there was a population out there that were very eager for these stories, and not just Latino population, but mainstream and other ethnicities and races. So it was, but that's how it began, with wanting to understand that experience, because I couldn't find anything in a book about it. And I go to stories to understand what's happening to me. So I guess I had to write it so I could have it as a story.
Yes, and why it was so refreshing of so many women seeing their stories reflected and having that aha moment, like, yes, this is what it's like, you know, but encounter between the cultures and the choque and how, you know, you girls adapted to the new culture and the new expectations. And then you went on to explore also the stories from the Dominican Republic, like in the time of the butterflies, such a rich history, and of these three sisters who were so brave to be fighting the Trujillo dictatorship, and that there was no novel about it. And then it became a movie too. And it's so gripping and so, you know, goes to your heart, such bravery. Can you talk a little bit about that novel?
Well, again, to you. It was a gap on the bookshelf, a silence, an omission that these sisters, three of whom were murdered by the dictator, one was left and survived to tell the story. So I found out in the process of writing about the three sisters that there was a fourth sister and she was still alive. But again, I wanted to understand the part of my history that was my parents' story. I wanted to understand that generation that had suddenly lost the agency and the freedom. I then, you know, now in the United States, was getting to claim. And so I wanted to understand that generation. I wanted that part of the history. And again, there have been books written about the dictatorship from the male point of view, but I wanted to understand the dictatorship from a woman's body, because it was a rapacious dictator who any woman he wanted. It was droit de seigneur. So women were on the cellular level, you know, terrorized and oppressed. Anyone's daughter or sister or mother or themselves could be suddenly taken for the dictator to enjoy, or if not, their family would be decimated. So I was interested in the dictatorship from the point of view of women. And that's why, you know, in the time of Trujillo, everything was, the dates were listed in terms of when Trujillo came to power in 1930. So 1950 would be 20th year of the era of Trujillo. The capital city, the name was changed from Santo Domingo to Ciudad Trujillo. Everything was owned by this oppressive dictator. And so I was interested also in wresting that time away from him and making it in the time of the butterflies, because Mariposas was their code name in the underground. So again, an effort to understand the generation of my parents, what they had lived through, and also to understand the history from a female point of view.
Yes, and you did it so beautifully. It's one of my favorite books. And then you took a similar take on that story, but for young readers in Before We Were Free, which is one of the ones I translated. And I recently had the opportunity to talk about this book with some students at a middle school in Pasadena, California, where I was invited. And they had read this book the year before, and they were still so excited about it. I remember so many of the details, and they gave me like this long list of really smart questions about it. And I was just, you know, I marvel again to see, and I'm sure you see that when you give presentations to children, young adults all the time, of, you know, your particular talent to in bringing like a very complex and sometimes harsh and crude reality that was Trujillo and his dictatorship, and breaking it down in a way that young readers can approach it and connect to it at such a deep level and remember it. See, because the teacher said, yeah, it's one of their favorite books ever, you know.
Well,
so
like,
how do you think you are able to break something so complex in terms that they can relate to it? And
well, you know, you become those characters a little bit like the actor. And so you tap that part of your own childhood or your experience of being a child. And since I had lived in the world of Anita, in that dictatorship at her age, I could access that. And so that part, you know, was to reach down and bring it back and all the sensual detail, sights, smells, little stories, characters, you know, some of them invented a conglomerate of people perhaps that I had known. The situation with Anita and her mother hiding out was based on a true story of the wife of a dissident and her young daughter that had to hide out. And so there were historical elements too. But, you know, again, writing to a gap on the shelf, I was aware that there were so many young adult and novels about the Holocaust and about Anne Frank and the casualties of, you know, oppressive governments in other countries. There were narratives for young adults about people, enslaved people in the United States. But there was this omission. I could find nothing about the many, many dictatorships that were up and down the Americas in the 20th century. And we think of the casualties of the dissidents or rebels or opponents of the regime. We think of them as casualties. But I thought, what about the children? You know, what
yes.
was... They lost their childhood with Before We Were Free. I wanted to capture the experience of the dictatorship from a child's point of view, because you know there were testimonials and there were history books and memoirs from dissidents and historians talking about those that were victims of dictators, military dictatorships in Argentina, etc. And I thought, what about the children? They also were casualties. They lost parents. They lost relatives. They lost their innocence. They lost their safety. They lost their childhood. And I saw that on the bookshelves when I went into elementary and middle schools. I saw so many books about the war, the Holocaust, children in war-torn Europe, even novels about children in enslaved in the south of the United States. But I thought, south of our border in the 20th century, we were afflicted with dictatorships, many of them supported by who else? The United States that helped them stay in power or put them in power. And what about those children? What about the casualties there? And so I wrote a novel based on the history in the Dominican Republic and a child that was embedded in persecution of her family. And she's called Anita because her cousin, across the ocean is Anne Frank. I mean, not literally. I just mean that I it was a nod to a book that was very powerful for me to read as a young reader.
Oh, I had a mother connection.
The Diary of Anne Frank.
Yes, so, yes, of course.
And, you know, one of my favorite children's books is La Composición, The Composition by Antonio Skármeta. It is an amazing book. It is my favorite book. And I gift it to so many schools and kids. It's translated into English as The Composition. And Antonio Skármeta is the one who wrote the script for Il Postino about Neruda.
Yes.
But this is an amazing children's book about a boy in a dictatorship in Chile. And it is so beautifully done. And it's a beautiful book.
Oh, so, I'll have to look.
I know. La Composición.
Wonderful. Yeah, you did a similar thing also for Finding Miracles, bringing the question of immigration from the southern border, from Mexico, into a little town in Vermont, and these children, and how making it real for them in busca de milagros, of how do you talk about such a big topic that you hear on the news, immigration. Some people portray immigrants as the evildoers, some people as the heroes, and how do these children are able to see it in their own lives and bring up these questions in a way that makes sense for them. And I think you did a great job with that one too.
Well, Finding Miracles, you mean the one about adoption?
Yes.
Well, you know, I was very interested in transcultural adoptees. You know, these kids that come and they are taken up in a, you know, Anglo mainstream family, and what happens to their histories. And so in Finding Miracles, I had a young girl who's been adopted, and she knows nothing about her history, and she wants to be like everyone else. So she's even somewhat embarrassed and ashamed that she is adopted. And so the novel, it's a YA novel, is about her coming to terms with her heritage and with the stories that were part of her past, which got disrupted when she was adopted. So again, you know, another silence or gap in this character's life that I wanted her to address and confront. So the reason it's called Finding Miracles is that her name in the orphanage was Milagros, but when she's adopted, she becomes Millie. And
so there's an erasure.
She finds Milagros, is able to find a connection to her past.
Yes. And speaking of embarrassment, that's also one of the themes of the how Tia Lola came to visit and stay, and then you had have a series of books under that name. And it's also the aunt from the Dominican Republic that comes to visit her acculturated niece and nephew in the United States. And at first they think she's strange and has these weird clothes and customs, but then of course they grow to love her very much. And so can you talk also about speaking Spanish and being made to feel ashamed? It also comes in some of your poems. Can you speak about how this inspiration for Tia Lola came to you?
Well, it's a homage, I think. A couple of things, but a homage to all those tías. I mean, I had a clan of tías, and they were wonderful. And I sort of combined a bunch of them and made my Tia Lola, who's a character. She's a kind of Mary Poppins, a Latina Mary Poppins, with her own little, you know, santeria and magic and her refranes and her special things she burns to clear the air of spirits. And you can imagine, you know, her niece and nephew acculturated and living in a small Vermont town feel like, oh my God, she's so weird, you know? and the other thing that I wanted to do is that I wanted to show nuance and complexity on what it means to be Latina or an immigrant. There's Tia Lola, who just arrived there's her niece, who is the parents of the kids, and she's in between. She's a hyphenated American Dominican. And then there's the kids who are really American kids, or that's what they want to be. So that to show that, you know, that it's not a monolithic ethnicity, even within a family. So that was part of the impetus for writing the series of books. There's four of them about Tia Lola. And the other thing is, she was so much fun to hang out with.
Yeah. Oh, my God. She's funny. She's really funny, too.
And she's fun. You know, she's, I just had a good time with her. And anyhow, you know, I did the first book and I thought, well, ya, se acabó. Bye-bye, Tia Lola. And she said, not so fast. She wanted a second book and then a third book. And then I said, okay, this is the last one. And there is a fourth book. And she seems happy with that.
Yes, and you have many other children's books that are all wonderful, beautifully illustrated. Which one has brought you the most joy when you talk to children and you keep reading some of these schools? I mean, you already talked about Tia Lola, who's a lot of fun, but yeah. Which other one?
Oh, you know, Liliana, you know how it is with your kids. You can't pick a favorite.
Yeah.
Because the other ones will clamor and shout and be very upset with me.
Yes.
I enjoy them all. Like our mommies used to say, you're all my favorites.
Yeah, you know, that's
true. And the favorite one is probably the, you know, when I'm in front of a group of kids and they've just read that book, that's, I'm inside it. So for the moment, that's the one I'm celebrating. And I, you know, I love Tia Lola. I mean, It's an excuse for me when I go to schools because I have a Tia Lola costume that I picked up little bits and pieces at the secondhand shop with a
yellow
mark. And I put my lunar, my little beauty mark on my face. And I put a...
You're really a performer.
I see. And I arrive and I just was in touch with a mother in our town who reminded me, her daughter's now in college, but when her daughter and her friends read it, I think in sixth grade or something, they were so taken with Tia Lola. So I threw a Tia Lola tea party. Well, I called it Tia Lola cafecito party, except it wasn't coffee. And everybody got a yellow boa scarf for their good luck. And this mom was telling me, Vivian still has her yellow scarf.
Wow.
So it can be fun.
Yes. Yeah, I bet. I bet.
Yeah.
And let's talk about, for a moment about your poetry, because you're also a poet and you're classically trained with within the English speaking tradition of the, you know, those rhythms that you grew up reading once you came to the United States. What can you tell us about your journey as a poet?
Well, that was my first love, poetry. You know, when we were little, I don't know if you all had to do this. Maybe it was part of my generation. We had to do recitations when mommy's friends would come over. Or when they
were. Yeah, declamación.
It was called declamación.
Yes.
Teníamos que recitar. And we each had our little repertoire, and I loved reciting. I would learn any poem by heart and recite it. And my signature piece was Rubén Darío. No, was it Rubén Darío? They go, este era un rey que tenía un palacio. Yeah, Rubén Darío,
sí,
un palacio.
Sí.
¿Cómo era?
Lleno de diamantes.
Un palacio de diamante, una tienda hecha del día, un rebaño de elefante.
Eso.
Y una princesita tan bonita, Margarita, tan bonita,
tan bonita como tú.
Oh, boy. And then I would finish, and my mother's friends would clap and say, oh, what is it? They would say, summa cum laude, summa cum laude. I didn't know what that meant. But I, you know, at one point I thought, maybe I can put that in my resume. Summa cum laude.
And one day you did.
Recitation. So, you know, I always loved poetry. And we were in oral culture. So there was a lot of poetry and refranes. And of course, you know, canciones. I loved all of it, loved all of it. So when we came into English, and I so missed my Spanish, I think I fell in love first with poetry because it was musical and it reminded me of my native tongue. And in the ways that I write English, part of the reason that I enjoy cadence and sometimes rhyme is because I'm writing my Spanish in English. I'm underneath the grid of the English line are the cadences and the root system and syntax and musicality of my Spanish. So
yes,
that was my first love and still my greatest love. But of course, it's so hard to find publishers for poetry, as you well know, Liliana, and to find readers. It's a small but very passionate readership of poetry. So the poems, you know, the poems are there. I'm now, after the Cemetery of Untold Stories, I'm putting together a collection of poems that I've been writing since my last poetry book in the early 2000s. And they've been in a drawer revisiting them.
Wonderful.
And the first poem, as a matter of fact, in the collection is Recitation.
Yes, that's strong about tradition.
We have that strong oral. Exactly. And you know, when I taught poetry workshop, I would make, oh my, they loved me. Let me tell you, they had to memorize a poem. That was the first assignment, a poem they loved, learn it by heart. I said, I want you to carry it in your body. I want the cells in your body. I want your bloodstream to be full of the poem. And then they had to come and recite it. And they grumbled about it. They were self-conscious. But I think in the end, they all enjoyed it. Because poetry is primarily for the ear. You know, it's music.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, you have some wonderful there. And I look forward to reading your new collection. So thank you. And I guess in the interest of time, you know, you have so many other books. I'm not going to be able to touch upon all of them. You know, I did read your Afterlife, which is kind of towards more the El Ocaso de la Vida, the latter years that I think you're also so good at describing the mature age and some of the concerns and losses and things that happen to women too, and from the point of view of women that haven't been found in literature very much up to now. And now this latest book, The Cemetery of Untold Stories, that maybe we can spend more time with since it's your latest novel. And with that, could you maybe read a section of The Cemetery of Untold Stories just to give our audience a taste of it, and then I'll read that same section in Spanish.
Well, this is
Spanish translation by Mercedes Gould.
This is towards the end of the novel, where Alma, whose pen name is Scheherazade, and I think that's for obvious reasons, the storyteller, has stopped writing and thinks her writing life is over. But lo and behold, I guess it isn't. Very faint at first, then louder as her ear becomes attuned to subtleties, Alma hears the sounds turning into scents. She opens a drawer for a spoon to stir the milk in her coffee, and the utensils are recounting their journey from the bauxite mines near Pedernales, how their red materials were gouged from the earth, transported onto ships, headed north to be converted to aluminum, molded into unnatural shapes and sharpness. The workers who handled them, the boxes they were packed in, the mouths they've filled with tasty treats, meats they've caught, sancochos they've been dipped in. Alma bangs the drawer shut, rinsing the spoon to wash away the story. But the water, too, has a tale to tell. how it bubbled out of the ground on the mountains of the Cordillera Central, a rivulet becoming a stream, trickling down, joining other streams, becoming a river, the putrid chemicals and trash dumped into its currents, the replenishing rains, the banks flooding the valleys, the insistent pressure to feed the sea, feed the sea. The shutters rattle, the wind picks up, blowing in from the ocean with the tale of where it has been, the sails it has filled, the desperate travelers aboard Yolas praying to Huracan, the stormy god, and to Our Lady of Altagracia for good fortune. May we reach Puerto Rico before the Coast Guard detects us. Each one on board has a story the wind carries.
De manera muy tenue al principio y luego más fuerte a medida que su oído se amolda a las sutilezas, va percibiendo que los sonidos se convierten en significado. Abre una gaveta en busca de una cuchara para revolver el café de su, la leche de su café, y los utensilios están relatando su viaje desde las minas de bauxita cerca de Pedernales y cómo el rojo material fue extraído de la tierra, transportado a barcos que navegaron hacia el norte para convertirse en aluminio y que lo moldearan en formas artificiales, filosas, y de los trabajadores que los manipularon, las cajas en las que los empacaron, las bocas que han llenado con comida apetitosa, la carne que han cortado, los sancochos en los que se han sumergido. Alma cierra la gaveta de golpe, enjuagando la cuchara para arrastrar el cuento. Pero el agua también tiene su propia historia, de cómo brotó fuera del suelo en las montañas de la Cordillera Central, un hilo que se transformó en arroyo, que fluyó corriente abajo y se unió a otros arroyos hasta volverse un río, de los pútridos químicos y la basura arrojada en su cauce, de las lluvias que lo reabastecían, las orillas que se abrían para inundar los valles, el insistente empuje para alimentar el mar, para alimentar el mar. Las persianas traquetean, el viento se levanta, soplando desde el mar con la historia de dónde ha estado, de las velas que ha hinchado. Los viajeros desesperados a bordo de las yolas, rezándole a Huracán, el dios de las tormentas, y a Nuestra Señora de la Altagracia para la buena suerte, y que ojalá lleguemos a Puerto Rico antes de que los guardacostas nos detecten. Cada uno de los que van a bordo tiene una historia que el viento lleva.
Thank you, Julia. I thought it was a beautiful, very lyrical, evocative segment, as you said, toward the end, when the main character realizes that even though she's been trying to literally bury all unfinished manuscripts in the dirt, in this made-up cemetery, there are stories everywhere, even in the natural elements, even in the objects, everyday objects. It's once your ears attuned to stories as a storyteller, there's no stopping. And you had also mentioned that it was originally parts of the novel are inspired in a Gabriela Mistral poem called La Contadora, The Storyteller. Can you tell us about that?
Bueno, in fact, I don't know where in El Cementerio de los Cuentos Sin Contar, in the Spanish edition, where it appears, but at one point Pepito, a kind of fan and wants to interview her, and breaks into where she's living now, sees her writing over and over on a notebook. And he wonders if it's something that, a new thing she's writing. And it's actually a line from this poem that I love by Gabriela Mistral, La Contadora. If people forgive me for my bad pronunciation and stumbling, I can read the very beginning.
Yes, of course, no worries.
La contadora, cuando camino, se levantan todas las cosas de la tierra y me paran y cuchichean, y es su historia lo que cuentan. Y las gentes que caminan en la ruta me la dejan y la recojo caída en capullos que son de huella. historias corre mi cuerpo o en mi regazo ronronean. Tantas son que no dan su respiro, zumban, hierven, abejean. Sin llamada se me vienen y contadas tampoco dejan. And she goes on and on.
Beautiful.
Yeah. She says, a medio camino quedo, entre ríos que no me sueltan. El coro se va cerrando y me atrapa en la rueda. Los ribereños me cuentan la ahogada sumida en hierbas y su mirada cuenta su historia. Y yo las tronco en mis palmas abiertas. Al pulgar llegan las de animales, al índice las de mis muertos, las de niños, de ser tantas en las palmas me hormiguean. Los viejos la quieren mentidas, los niños las quieren ciertas, todos quieren oír la historia mía, que en mi lengua viva está muerta. So it's just, this is very much, you know, what the book embodies, what the novel embodies, that if you listen, the whole world is storying. It's not just, you know, if you go into a library or a bookstore, or if you go into to a reading by a professional writer, everybody's walking around with stories. And if they detect a good listener, they'll tell you their story. And so this poor contadora can't get away from them.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what Alma is discovering. She can say, I'm done. My narrative life is over, pero not so fast. The earth is there. It's storying. And so, yeah, she can't silence that.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it's a beautiful way to bring it together, inspired in the Nobel Prize winner from Chile, one of the few women and from the continent who have earned that distinction.
And got the Nobel Prize in literature, right?
Yes, for her poetry, which was very unusual.
Yeah. Yep.
And her poems still speak to us.
Exactly.
Just showed. So, yeah. And what does it mean to you to have this book also appear in Spanish, as I said, in translation, a beautiful translation by Mercedes Gull? And of course, you've had other books appear in Spanish. But what does it mean in this moment that we're living in?
Well, I think, you know, this is the first time that the book appears simultaneously in English and Spanish. And I'm really so gratified by that, especially for this book, because part of what Alma, the protagonist, does is she wants to go back to the homeland where her stories came from. She wants to lay them to rest where they came from. They have been co-opted, taken to the United States, because she feels like these stories that came from our so-called third world of that northern country. And it's sort of like the brain drain, or the feeling that many of us have that, you know, we sort of extracted some of the richnesses that we've brought into English. And there's another way to look at it. Of course, it's creating bridges. It's connecting. It's getting an American or English readership to realize, to connect with our history and our stories. But there's a pang with that. And so Alma returns her characters to their homeland to rest. So it's so important for me that the novel is also in Spanish, because most of the book takes place en un cementerio in the Dominican Republic, en un barrio, surrounded by Dominicans who are very curious about what's going on with this strange gringa dominicana who's come and is doing something weird with this property. So I wanted them. It matters so much to me that the book goes home into Spanish.
Yes, it will be a true homecoming, and I'm sure you'll have events in both places and hopefully in many Spanish-speaking countries, which I know sometimes it's hard to get the Spanish translation into Latin America, but I hope you're able to do that and for people to enjoy this wonderful novel. And speaking of that, which, I mean, you mentioned that you're working on the poetry collection and any other projects that you are going to work on after this tour?
Bueno, I'm getting old, and I have so many ideas. Like Alma, I have so many boxes.
Yes.
So many drafts. And I always thought, someday I've got to get to it. Someday I've got to finish this. Someday I'll put it together. Someday this, you know, novel that is blocked will unblock, and I'll be able to access my characters. And now, you know, I'm going to be 74 next week. Yeah, there's not that much time. And I'm, you know, realizing that not all of them will get told. I think that's part of the impetus, too, with this novel, you know, sort of looking at that straight in the eye, that the clock is ticking and it won't be me. But you know what? It doesn't matter. It's not après moi le déluge, après moi el silencio. There are other storytellers coming up. They'll pick up. There's never going to be an end to story, because we're the critter that uses narrative the way a bee makes honey, a silkworm makes silk. We tell stories, and they will keep coming. So I'll keep working and writing, and more, you know, I think slowing down a bit, because I just don't have the stamina and the energy or the eyesight to keep up with it. But I think for me, it's just part of my practice of being the way I process life, to write it down, to put it in language, to sing it in a poem.
Yes. Yeah. Well, congratulations on your upcoming birthday. And and I think you did like this kind of farewell novel, even though it's not your last book, but you did it in a very ingenious way. Like as you said, looking it straight in the eye and saying, okay, what about all these unfinished manuscripts? Where are they going to rest, or are they going to rest, or is someone else going to take them over? But yet you still manage to tell the stories of two of these characters who refuse to be buried, including the one of the wives, or I guess official wives of Trujillo, and going like, well, what about her? You know, what was her story? And she refuses to be forgotten. So I think it was done in a very clever, entertaining, and almost meta way, looking at it from the outside, but yet we really get into the stories and the characters.
Yeah, I guess I hope it's not my last book, but it would there would be something fitting and appropriate about this being the final one.
Yeah, no, I don't think it will be, but
well, and there's still storytelling and oral literature, and I can tell stories even if they're not written down. I can't stop myself, as you can tell from this interview.
Well, you've had such a rich life, and your papers are also now at the Harry Ransom Center here at the University of Texas at Austin. So that's also a treasure trove that, you know, people will continue to explore and investigate and enjoy for many years to come. So we're very fortunate to have the archives.
In a sense, the archives are my cementerio.
Yes.
Locked up. you know, beware. If you open up the archives of Julia Alvarez, who knows what character will spring out and haunt you. So anyhow, no, it's special to feel like the drafts and the you know, the papers and the all of it has found a place, you know. And I don't need a gravestone. I don't even need to be buried, because my heart is in those archives. And what else is there to say?
Yes, now I remember when you were in the process of packing and sending boxes, and so you must also feel lighter, you know, just to be in the moment and live life and enjoy. lives.
Bueno, Liliana, if you go down to our basement or you talk to Bill, my husband, there's as many boxes as I shipped. because there's more. There's more. And there's some things I kept thinking, I know, pero I'm going to go back to this. I need these characters here with me. Pero bueno,
yes.
I don't know what time I will have.
Well, I hope it will be long and enjoyable and fruitful and surrounded by all the people who love and care for you and all the readers. So
bueno.
I think on that note, we can finish. This interview has been a pleasure to have you here on Hablemos Escritoras. We have you in this podcast, and also we'll have you in the encyclopedia so people can see all your different books and a biography. So thank you so much for making the time to speak with us.
Well, thank you for your patience and letting me as a sort of hybrid of the two cultures to be part of an amazing group of escritoras. And
you're part of it for sure. Yes.
Thank you. And so gracias. And as we say in the Dominican Republic, tal vez in your countries as well, colorín colorado. Este podcast se ha acabado.
Okay, muchas gracias, Julia.
Un abrazo. Thank you, Liliana and Adriana. Can we see you now, Adriana? I would love to see you, Adriana.
Así de linda y de amena fue esta conversación entre Julia Álvarez y Liliana Valenzuela. Me dio muchísimo gusto estar yo tras bambalinas, escuchando tantas anécdotas y una manera tan comprometida de regresar a otras escritoras y otras lecturas. Qué gran evento tener a Julia Álvarez en Hablemos Escritoras. Quedamos en deuda con Julia Álvarez, con Liliana Valenzuela y con Viviana Castiblanco. Yo soy Adriana Pacheco y como siempre es un placer estar con ustedes cada semana. Nos escuchamos en el próximo episodio.